when we are attentionally and emotionally invested in things that live in the future, particularly goals and expectations, we think they are motivating us, we think they are building confidence, and we think they are driving our effort, when the opposite is actually true.
Welcome to the Mental Training Lab. I'm Pete Kadushin, your host, and my job is to have fun conversations that leave you with actionable tools, little experiments that will help you improve your mindset and mental skills so that you can do the things you love at a higher level. In today's episode, Raymond Pryor comes back to tackle some common myths we hear in the performance psychology world. And honestly, one of my favorite games is to poke the bear, and so I tossed some of these cliches out at Raymond to see if I could get him riled up. I also tried and failed to make this a lightning round, right? To move a little bit faster. And the truth is it ended up being a lot to dig into as we discussed things like just be positive and fake it till you make it. And we close today's show with a discussion of Raymond's new book, Golf Beneath the Surface. It's now available anywhere you find your books, and it is very much worth your time if you're interested in performing your best more consistently. Anyway, enough of that. We're just going to get right into it. I hope you enjoy part three with Raymond Pryor. Okay, I want to do a quick lightning round.
Let's zap away.
So I just want to get your initial impact when I throw out a few common things shared in the performance psychology world.
Okay.
We already brushed up against one, so I'm going to bring it back around. Mm. Think positive.
Yeah. Not helpful for us. I would say as a general rule of thumb, you can be as positive as you want as long as it's truthful. Because when we are being positive, when things aren't necessarily positive, again, we are doing two things. We are creating two tasks. One is deal with your current reality. The other is try to create a more positive reality. And really what that means is I have a difficult current reality and I'm trying to make myself feel better about it when I don't actually feel better about it, which is then creating that disparity between my direct feedback loop and the one that I should be in. So it would be the opposite of acceptance. So positivity we're finding when we try to smother difficult things, including difficult performance or feeling uncomfortable internally with positivity, it ends up having really the opposite effect where you're really not acknowledging your current experience and then therefore creating a larger disparity between what you want to feel and what you do feel. And then we become less functional. So like I said, nothing morally wrong with positivity, but in situations where things aren't super positive, it tends to actually be more disruptive than just dealing with your current reality and accepting it as it is. And then making an intentional choice and a directed choice about what you want to do in response.
Yeah. Susan David, emotional agility author, she talks about the tyranny of false positivity.
Yeah.
Right. That idea that we're told often that we should look on the bright side or there's a silver lining, and this sense that what ends up happening is we wash right over the actual felt experience of it, which is often profoundly unpleasant, right? We just didn't get the thing we wanted. We lost the game, we lost our job, we lost a spouse, whatever. Mm-hmm. Right, to just say, well, there's a silver lining. Well, that may be true. And let's not neglect the experience you're having right now.
Yeah, it's kind of invalidating your current reality. It also, if we're talking confidence, I don't necessarily define confidence, stable confidence at least, as trust. I think stable confidence is built on honesty. How stable is your confidence if you're lying to yourself and you know it? And oftentimes when we're smothering things with positivity, we're kind of lying to ourselves. Like you said, like maybe there's a silver lining.
Right. So
there might not be.
So I'm going for number two then, because I said lightning round, and actually we're going to get back.
You know, okay.
So fake it till you make it, which you hear all the time.
Yeah. Fake it till you make it is perhaps one of the most disruptive and dangerous ways to try to build confidence, simply because you are lying to yourself about what you're experiencing. Feeling comfortable and feeling certain is not required to be confident, not in a stable way anyway. When we are faking confidence, the underlying mechanism for our confidence is inauthentic. And It doesn't take a psychologist to figure out that when we are inauthentic, we're not very happy, we're not very healthy, we're not very high functioning human beings. There's been a ton of research on ways that you can fake confidence, whether it's a power pose or a positive statement that you just repeat to yourself or something. And they've all been debunked a million times over and over again that building stable confidence is really not about being faked. And if you are going to build something that you can rely on when things get difficult, faking it is just not going to do it. I mean, if you think about it, imagine what it would be like if you were saying, how confident are you in this person as your friend? And you knew the whole time they were lying to you or faking their friendship with you. Like it would be disingenuous and you wouldn't have a whole lot of confidence in it. So fake it till you make it, awful approach. I wouldn't recommend it for anybody.
Well, so I'm gonna take the other side. This isn't part of the lightning round. This mm-hmm. is just devil's advocating. We need belief in our ability on some level, right? Self-efficacy can be helpful. And so there are times where if I've never been in a situation, right? So I've never played in the Super Bowl, right? And it's going to be really hard for me to draw from previous experience for me to be able to say, you know what, when things get tough in this specific context, I can still believe in my capacity to do this. And so it might be helpful potentially to say, you know what, I'm going to act as if I've been in the Super Bowl before, right? And that maybe this isn't as big a deal and so on and so forth and the cascade of thoughts. What would you say to that, sir?
I would say that would fall into the neutral category of potential responses you could have to that. I think what might be more helpful for someone is paying attention to the feedback loop that tells you just because you feel different and it's a situation that you haven't been in doesn't mean that you don't have the capacity to handle it. So that's kind of your belief part. But the self-efficacy is really not built on, I'm pretty sure I can do this. It's built on, I'm pretty sure I can handle it when it gets hard. And so if you are then tuned into, okay, I haven't been here before, but when it gets hard, what am I going to go to? Whether that's an action, a shift in focus, et cetera. Because you know, if you haven't played in the Super Bowl before, it is a different experience. There is no doubt about that. But the thing that is required for you to perform well is still the same. And so if you're trying to fake your way through other things, it gets harder to perform well and do the things you already do. So I would say there are more authentic ways that are not fake. And your what you were alluding to falls to me more in the authentic category than the just like, oh, just pretend you're comfortable the whole time or go power pose in the bathroom before you go to your press conference so that you can play well on Sunday. Like, I just don't think that's going to be super helpful for people.
And I think it's worth coming back to your point about self-efficacy. And self-efficacy is just our belief in our ability in a specific context,
right?
So I can have high self-efficacy playing tennis, but low self-efficacy bowling. All right, so global confidence, then confident just as an athlete or a mover or a thinker or whatever, but we get down into the nitty gritty.
Yeah.
And so your point here is that it's not so much, I believe, and you've talked about certainty a lot. It's not, I believe that I'm going to be able to execute because it's the Super Bowl.
Right.
It's, I believe that when things get difficult, I can handle that. And things will get difficult because it's the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
I think this is where I approach stable confidence versus junk food confidence from, yeah. Or
it's
fragile
good, it's
confidence.
It's a really good, yeah, I would use the word unstable. You use the word junk food, alluding to the same thing, which is like, if you build your confidence off of shaky stuff, it's going to get shaky.
And so that, for me, coming back to what can I control, right? And we've talked already about expanding that zone in which we can operate, right? So when I can have a wider array of internal experiences and still do my job.
Yeah.
Right. Then I'm going to have a pretty strange internal experience leading up to a gold medal match or leading up to the Super Bowl or leading up to the biggest interview of your life.
Yeah.
Right? If I've trained up until that point to have belief in my ability to operate under that type of duress.
Yeah.
Right. That for me is really where confidence is at.
Yeah. And even if you're just talking the basics of fake it till you make it, what you're doing is you're creating a second task for yourself, which is do your skills and execute them as intended and also try to make yourself feel more confident. And that makes it harder to do the thing you're doing. And then it also creates those feedback loops that you're talking about. They become more disruptive rather than being aware of those feedback loops and knowing how you want to respond intentionally. single tasks you on what do I need to do to actually execute my skills. And by the way, I also believe that, like, I'm pretty sure I can handle this. It's a lot harder to tell yourself, I'm pretty sure I can handle this, while you're also trying to make yourself feel better.
So that one we're going to put firmly in the debunked category for
debunked.
You. Okay. Next one is, it's not about getting rid of the butterflies. It's about teaching them to fly in formation.
I don't even know what that means, to be honest with you. I think that is just some well-intentioned cliche that is actually physiologically incorrect. So for our listeners, when we're feeling nervous, we often feel that sensation in our stomach that we call butterflies. What that actually is physiologically is, because we are in a state of heightened arousal, what basically our fight, flight, or freeze response, which includes a cascade of physiological reactions. One of those reactions is that the blood from our abdomen that's running our digestive systems and protecting and feeding our internal organs moves out to our limbs because we might need to fight, flight, or freeze. And the feeling of that blood being rapidly pumped from our abdomen out to our limbs is the feeling of butterflies. That's just one of those sensations we feel when we might be under pressure, and our body knows that score counts and our brain knows it too. I don't think you need to get them to fly in formation. What I think that's a really good indicator of is, like, your body is getting ready to perform. Like, it knows score counts. If there are a couple of things in our body and brain that it does that are, like, if it was a pill or an injection, would be a banned substance. Nerves is one of them. Nerves are such a good thing for performance. It narrows focus for us if we know where to put it, and it makes us faster. It makes you more athletic, basically, because you are running on adrenaline. So if you can recognize those butterflies as a feedback loop and know how to align your focus and how to intentionally execute your skills, you are better than you are when you're just relaxed, so to speak.
So I'm going to give this one a half pass.
It's a half bunk.
Because the point being made here is that it's not about getting rid of them.
Yeah,
right?
You can't.
And the other point that you made, I think, is really important, is that nerves are like NOS. I'm a sucker for Fast and Furious movies. I can't help it. I'm not proud of it, but I can't help it. And yeah. It really is. If you can get it harnessed and aimed in the right direction, you are going to be better for having activated your body.
That's right.
And we also know from all of the flow science that the window into flow is through the skylight. You actually have to come down from nerves into that state. You can't crank up into it. You can't climb in through the basement.
Our awareness level and alertness levels are if they're too low, we can't be in flow state. Right. So like you said, nerves are almost a requirement for flow state. Like, we almost need to be physiologically activated. Like, we're very rarely in flow state in performance settings where the outcome doesn't matter enough for our body to recognize it and respond.
I mean, we can't be, because the neurochemical cascade won't start.
If there isn't a recognition that something meaningful is at stake, right? So if you're an athlete who likes to perform better, or any performer in any way, that whatever, I know the actors and actresses and pop stars I work with, like, if they're not nervous before performance, they're typically like, uh-oh, hold on a second. How do I get myself engaged with this? Because they're not really, they're not going to be firing on all cylinders when they hit the stage. And that goes for a lot of athletes too. Like, if athletes, there are a couple of times they've said, Raymond, can you turn off my nerves? I'm like, first of all, I can't, and I wouldn't. Your nerves. Anxiety is a different story though. Because anxiety is physiological arousal that results from worry about the future. And nerves are, we are jazzed up for now.
Well, and it's important to tease those out, because nerves can often come wrapped in anxiety, and we can start to think of them as aversive.
They have similar, in some ways, very similar physiological feedback loops, even though the cognitive and neurological sources and functioning are very different, or different enough. One is on time and one is not, in basic terms.
Yeah, I mean, one gives you the freedom to be on time, and the other one continues to drag you into the future.
That's right. A very pessimistic future.
And there's example after example of high performers, whether it's athletes or otherwise, who continue to experience profound nerves before big games, before big performances, and that this was actually an important part of their sort of checklist and their pre-flight. Yeah, I'm ready to go.
Yeah. And to your point on us needing, we actually have to kind of down-regulate into flow state, so to speak. There's a reason that the extreme sport athletes experience flow state more than others, and because there's a grounding nature and a nervous nature to danger. And so if you're jumping out of a plane or you're driving a snowmobile and doing a backflip in it, like there's a lot at stake. And so you're going to have to downregulate. And when, and those people who are really good at extreme sports have figured out either organically or in a systematic way how to take nerves and be grounded. And that's what allows them to, one, do their thing well enough, not only to be good at it, to be safe at it, but also to get the feel, like, you know, you hear the term adrenaline junkie, like they're really flow junkies, flow state junkies.
Yes.
And they should be, because flow state is, like I said, we're talking about banned substances. Flow state would be a banned substance if it was a pill.
Well, because everybody would just be sitting around taking the pill all the time.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, if we're getting into kind of the nitty gritty of like clinical psychology and stuff, like addiction is people seeking the feeling of being in flow from substances that can't do it, but mimic it for short periods of time, which is why we build a tolerance to it. But also the danger with that is that it comes with a whole bunch of other stuff, but that's another podcast.
That is not my wilderness survival podcast either.
Sure.
All right. So we worked our way through the lightning round.
It was so fast.
I mean, it was faster than it could have been.
Yeah.
Right. There was a number of paths we could have diverged onto.
Yeah.
And so then I'm going to pivot a little bit, because I want to sort through some of this with you. And so I'm going to lay out three different concepts, and then I want you to give me the landscape of how they are connected, maybe how they aren't.
Sure.
And then I'll incessantly interrupt, because it's...
Can't wait.
My show. I get to do it. Okay. So the three different flavors we're going to be working with. So we've got goals, intentions, and expectations. Mm. Ready, go.
Just off the top of my head, you just mentioned three things that are very prominent in a variety of different places, whether that's education, performance psychology, coaching, et cetera, and all wildly overrated. So an expectation, for example, is what we expect to happen. And quite often we have these big lofty expectations, and often performance doesn't ever really play out that way. And so if you have this really crisp, clear, even dare I say, we make our expectations, like when we say high expectations, we say we really, what we're talking about is like easily performing or being perfect or all these things. And very rarely does that happen. So the higher your expectations are, oftentimes you're teeing yourself up for a state that we call negative surprise, which is I expected this and I get less than this. Which again, now we're just seeing there's a disparity between my current reality and this imaginary reality I have. And we as humans don't, our reflex often from our survival brain to negative surprise is dwelling or anxiety, which again are two states that disrupt our ability to physically perform skills.
And so dwelling being stuck in the past.
Stuck in the past. That shouldn't have happened. How did that happen? I can't believe that happened. So like essentially the more rigid and high, quote unquote, your expectations are, you're actually teeing yourself up for negative surprise. Expectations are also kind of work in the opposite direction of acceptance. Like acceptance is this just willingness to see how the future plays out without it needing to be scripted, which gives us a ton of space to operate within. And it also makes negative surprise like minimal at most. And what that does, like it's hard for people to wrap their head around the idea of like, well, if I don't have high expectations, how am I going to be motivated? How am I going to evaluate my performance? Like you don't need that. Like if you understand motivation on its deeper levels or how to objectively evaluate your performance, like expectations are not required. And what I would say is expectations also often live in the future. And if you're emotionally and intentionally invested in your expectations, just like outcome-based goals, it's not that they're bad. They don't live in a time frame that you're in right now. And if you always have one eye, one foot, whatever in your future expectations and goals, or even I would say intentions here, you're off time. And if you're off time, it's harder to execute your skills. And I'll let you get to it. Interrupt me in a second here. But the body of research around these three areas is really clear. When we are attentionally and emotionally invested in things that live in the future, particularly goals and expectations, we think they are motivating us. We think they are building confidence, and we think they are driving our effort, when the opposite is actually true. We find that people that are more rigidly attached to their goals and expectations, first things first, their effort is really inconsistent. The second thing is they don't like taking risks, because they're always protecting their goals and their expectations. And the other thing that we find out is that they're at a high risk for burnout, because they're constantly seeing the disparity between where they want to be and where they want to go. And so I'm not saying that having goals and expectations is bad, but if you can't move off of them when it's time to perform or rest and recover, they eat you up.
So the thing that stood out to me just there is that there's different flavors of expectation, mm-hmm. right? So there's the expectation that this is going to be easy.
Sure.
Which is a global, and from a temporal standpoint, it really overlays, if we want to stick with the golf, it's going to overlay the entire 18 holes.
Yeah. You are now expecting something in many moments rather than the one you're in.
I'm going to cruise.
That's
I'm
right.
Gonna, right? I was feeling great yesterday.
Quite frankly, it's a fantasy.
There's expectations like, well, I expect to be able to win this tournament, mm-hmm. which is way out in the future.
Yeah.
There's also expectations for the shot right in front of you. And so I think what I was hearing is that those aren't actually created equal, right? So there's an expectation for this shot, which mm-hmm. we might be, here's what I think is going to happen when I finish swinging.
Yeah.
Which is more in my control. Control was starting to bubble up for me as you were talking through that.
Bubble up a little bit. Yeah, I would say far more effective expectations for us would revolve something around, I actually expect whatever, I don't know what's going to happen, but I expect there's going to be some real challenge involved. And I expect that those challenges are going to require me to have to respond effectively. If those were the expectations that more people brought into their performance, they would, one, be on time in the present more often, and be more mindful of how they are responding to challenge in a state of essentially not a negative surprise, because you would be expecting challenges and having to respond. And then if you don't have to, positive surprise, which is, hey, I got more than I expected. And if you don't, you got exactly what you expected. And then it tends to be less disruptive for us.
Do you think that it's possible as a high performer to not have expectations heading into a performance?
No. I think it's far more important to pay attention to them and to be able to detach from them. You and I are going to go play golf tomorrow. I have a relative expectation of like what my score range could be. Whether I expect that or not is no bearing about what it's actually going to be. What's going to determine how well I score is how well I execute my skills, among some other external factors. So what I expect is really irrelevant. If instead I pay attention to that and create some expectations about, well, there's going to be some difficulty involved and it's going to require me to have to adjust and be able to ground and reground myself as things are going on, I'll have a much better chance of actually getting the outcomes that I want. But what I expect to happen is almost irrelevant. So I think it's far more important that we pay attention to those expectations, what form they come in and how they are serving us. So again, that's that mindful awareness of, one, what is it? Am I paying attention to it? But also paying attention, almost asking ourselves the question, what are the natural consequences of this? Because I think so many people are so into goal setting. And I think if they took a step back and go, hold on a second, what is all this goal setting actually doing for me? Not what I feel like it's doing for me, or not does conventional wisdom tell me it's doing for me? What is it actually doing for me? I think you see far more people that go, actually, this is creating a significant amount of anxiety for me. It's making me more rigid and less flexible psychologically. It's taking me off time. And ultimately, it is undermining my intrinsic motivation. And if we're talking about motivation that is better for long-term performance, intrinsic is what drives the ship.
Well, this was actually something that blew my mind when I listened to the Huberman Lab podcast on dopamine.
Yeah.
Where he pointed out that you know, if you're in the middle of practicing and it's something challenging and you're thinking about, here's what I'm going to get at the end of it.
Yes.
The skill's going to be better. Another example used, you're working out and you're thinking about the smoothie you're going to get afterwards,
yeah,
or how much weight you're going to lose, all that stuff that's kind of goal-based or expectation-based and it's out in the future.
Yep.
Then that's actually making it less motivating to engage in the task.
There are literally 100 studies, and I know the number is actually right about 100, that assess people's just level of motivation and enjoyment when they are on time and when they're off time. There's actually a really cool study by a couple of dudes at Harvard called A Wandering Mind is an Unhappy Mind, where they set up this really cool thing where they basically sent people an app that asked three questions, and it would like ping them with an alert, and it would ask three questions. One, it would ask you, where are you physically? So, you know, say at the dinner table. Where are you psychologically? Ooh, still at work. Or anticipating something. You know, I can't wait till I get home and have a beer or do whatever. And then the third question was just like, how happy are you on a scale of 1 to 10? And what they found was people who are on time are happier people. You would be better off doing a task that is less enjoyable, but be present. That would be more enjoyable than doing something you really enjoy, but being off time in it. And so if you are always anticipating an outcome, whether that's a goal, an intention, or an expectation, it's taking us out of the thing. It's making it less enjoyable, and we are less motivated to do it because we always have one eye on, well, what's going to make it worth it for me to endure this experience, rather than just like, well, the experience is valuable in and of itself. And that, we're getting kind of into the nitty gritty of like psychology about people who have really long, more successful and more enjoyable careers is they are far more intrinsically motivated than extrinsically motivated, which means their attachment to goals, expectations, and outcomes is far less than we perceive on the outside.
Yeah. One of the ways I think about intrinsic motivation is that difference between the finite game and the infinite game.
Yeah.
Right. That for people who are intrinsically motivated, right, they're doing it because there's something that's in alignment for them,
yeah,
with the experience or the suite of experiences that come. So we think about professional athletes, the ones that it's the right rhythm for them as human beings. And there's a certain joy that they get, not from everything,
mm-hmm,
right? But they get to be present and fully invested while they're practicing, while they're in the weight room, while they're recovering, while they're out playing. And that's not something that they want to end. They don't want to go, hey, I hope I win a championship and then I'm going to hang it up.
That's right.
Right. Which would be the finite game, right? I want to beat the person and then, or beat the team and then good, I've climbed the top of the mountain.
Right.
And so it makes sense to me that the people who are going to want the game to keep going, who want more people to play.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, let's all get together and keep this thing rolling are going to be the ones who are going to be successful over the long term because of the things that you need to do.
Yeah.
Which are sometimes unpleasant,
are still kind of enjoyable to them
because they're willing to be on time while they do it.
That's right. It's a more enjoyable experience, even though it might not be comfortable. It's enjoyable. And those are two different things. Like comfort and enjoyment are not necessarily the same. And when you are more present, something can be uncomfortable, but still be enjoyable for you and valuable to you. When you're always at the end, I got to get an A, I got to get to the finish line, it draws us out, and now the experience only becomes valuable if we get the result. And when that happens, again, now you're starting to create disparity between your current reality and an imaginary reality. It's not surprising to me why you have players like a Tom Brady, or even this week, you know, Serena is kind of doing her farewell tour at the US Open. And she was very clear, I'm retiring, but I don't really want to. Like the people who have careers that are that long and that successful and have a harder time stepping away because the thing is so enjoyable to them, but their body just won't let them do it, or their skills have diminished with age. Like they're running on intrinsic motivation, and they are, don't get me wrong, they want to win everything that they compete with. Like they will steal your lunch money if they think that it can give them a chance to win. But what is really driving the experience is that they are just loving the experience. They are intrinsically motivated to do it. It's really difficult to have that type of deep love for deep work if you're only extrinsically motivated or just heavily extrinsically motivated. And when you're talking about expectations and goals, typically the ways we construct those take us away from that.
Yeah, they are backloaded in a way that says,
defer gratification, which is a big, I mean, this used to be like one of the key components to mental toughness and to grit, right?
Idea that we used to think that people were just suffering through something in order to get something that they really want later, when actually we're finding out actually the thing they're doing is not, they don't have to delay anything. There's no, they are finding gratification in the thing, even though it's uncomfortable.
And the famous example was the marshmallow study where, you know, you put one marshmallow in front of a kid and then lock them in a room with a bunch of like one-way mirrors where you can videotaping them. And then you say,
poor kids,
if you can just stare at this marshmallow for fill in the blank. I don't know. I think
it was like 5 or 15 minutes or something.
If you can do that, you're going to get more marshmallows later.
More marshmallows. Yeah.
And, you know, then they tracked the kids who are willing to not eat the marshmallow now, as if there was something shameful about eating the marshmallow now.
Yeah, you weak little kid for eating candy.
Even though you've set an environment where there's nothing in
there's
front
really
of them.
Nothing
there's
else like,
there's
for
nothing going on except for the marshmallow. And they followed these people afterwards, and they used these different predictors of success to say, oh, the people who wait for the more marshmallows are going to be more successful.
Yeah.
Which may have been true
some kids, maybe.
In a very like practical sense.
Yeah.
And the point you're making is that we don't have to suffer a long road of joyless, marshmallowless experience to get the thing at the end of the rainbow.
Well, and if we're using the marshmallow study, did the kid delay eating that marshmallow because they just suffered through that 5 minutes, or did they turn the 5 minutes of waiting for marshmallow into a game that was really fun?
I would love to do a follow-up study where we explored what the psychological experience was as this was unfolding.
I mean, I would love to see the videotapes of it, just like the raw video, because my guess is far more of the kids that were able to delay gratification are just like the people who are high performers and people who just love their jobs or love whatever it is that they do. Like, the thing is more enjoyable than the byproduct. And so then when we're like, oh, wow, look at their patience, or look at how disciplined they were, like, it actually wasn't patience or discipline. Like, they were just enjoying, like, it wasn't a difficult thing for them to do. And I don't mean that it's easy. I also don't mean that it's comfortable, but I mean, like, they're finding the experience valuable and gratifying, and so that there's nothing really to delay.
Well, so it's, for me,
it's bringing them into it, essentially.
And it's in alignment, right? In a way that it costs energy. It's like you said, it's not easy, and it's not layering on additional challenge and
That's
making
right.
it harder.
That's right.
Because I have to be disciplined, but deeply, deeply, I want that marshmallow.
That's right. Yeah. Right?
And I better not, because I'm going to be a bad boy if
sure.
I do.
And if we're really talking like the nuts and bolts of delayed gratification, we can kind of poke holes in it, because, again, that would imply that I am consciously willpowering my reflexes off. But in situations where our old brain feels necessary, it just overpowers and turns off the young brain, in which case then like the idea of willpower and discipline is actually like pretty much debunked. The reason people are quote unquote disciplined or express willpower is because like that is a deeply reinforced process for them that actually provides them a feeling of reward. And so we're all disciplined about things. It's really a matter of what we're disciplined about and what we have turned into reflexes. And if you're a kid and you go, oh, there's a marshmallow, I can turn it into a game. You'll sit there for 20 minutes. No problem. And if you're Tom Brady and watching film for 8 hours a day is gratifying to you, like for somebody who hates watching film, they're like, how does he possibly do that? But if you peel apart his psychology, you're like, how does he not?
Well, and for folks who are in the first category who want to do the things that are going to make them successful.
Yeah.
And you know, we talked earlier about rewiring your direct experience.
That's right.
Right. And this actually comes out of that same podcast on dopamine, is finding a way in the moment to contact, to ground yourself in the present experience.
Yeah. Can you align yourself in it? Not by trying to get out of it.
By being on time and then saying, okay, well, not only is this going to do something valuable for me later, and I can be just deeply immersed in the experience as I'm doing it.
Right.
Right. That actually starts to rewire it, so that I'm not using all this top down extra energy to willpower myself to sit down in front of the stupid thing and watch the film. The film then becomes not just useful for as a means to an end, but it becomes part of what's in line and coherent with you as a human being.
Yep. And as you say that, I just think about our current educational system and how it kind of does the exact opposite. right? We throw these grades at the end of it and tell kids they got to get grades, and it's actually drawing them away from just enjoying learning. And one of the things psychologically for us, you know, learning feels really good for our brain. And so when we take ourselves out of just being present in the learning process by sticks and carrots, learning doesn't become very, like, we wonder why these kids hate going to school. Well, because we've created a sticks and an extrinsically motivated sticks and carrots environment for something that is inherently enjoyable.
Well, this is an important point. The environment will often supersede whatever the individual is trying to do with either their old or their young brain.
It can.
So if we're marinating constantly in an environment that says it's all about the number of championships you've won, yep, or the number of how big is the money at the end of the season, or how many A's did you get this year? Mm-hmm. That over time, even the people who are deeply intrinsically motivated,
yeah,
that it's going to be really challenging for them to maintain that in the face of the extrinsic punishment or the extrinsic reward.
100%. And again, if we're looping back to flow state as kind of a reference point, because it is the optimal state of human functioning, it is also a psychological state of intrinsic motivation without goal striving. And there's a reason, because if we are extrinsically motivated and goal striving, we can't really be present very effectively, because the primary characteristic of flow state is immersion in the task at hand in the present moment.
Well, and I'll step that back just a bit, because I think what we've started to tease out is there's a difference with our three things here, the expectations, intentions, and goals. There's a difference between ones that are thrown way out in the future, mm-hmm, and then the one that's right in front of me. Mm-hmm. Because one of the other components to flow state is immediate feedback on the task at hand.
Right.
And so if I have a clear idea of what the immediate goal is, and so for a rock climber, it could be moving from this point to the next point. For a golfer, it's going to be whatever shot's right in front of them.
Yeah.
Right. For a hockey player, it's this shift.
Yeah.
Right. If I can immerse myself in that task, I need clear marching orders. Right. But it has to be my very next step. Right. It can't be, well, if I do this step and then the next step after that and the one after that, and then I'm going to eventually be that.
That's right.
And so the point you've been really drilling home is that the way we set these up often pulls us from the present moment. And so I'm going to make a bold statement. The goals and intentions that work are the ones that allow us or bring us to the present moment.
Yeah. How they are constructed temporally and attentionally determine how effective they are for us.
And that was overly dramatic. It wasn't a bold statement.
It was pretty bold. I think it's in direct opposition to how most people are conceptualize goals, think about what's a good goal and what's not, quote unquote, and also what gets preached to people. There's still a massive amount of people just telling people you got to set big goals, and if you don't, then you know, your why is not big enough. And when I got an email from a client the other day, it was like, hey, there's a guy at the club who was telling me that if I'm not feeling motivated, it's because my goals aren't big enough. I'm like, actually, you might want to make them smaller and a little bit closer to you, and also a little bit more in line with your current reality than an imaginary reality. That might shift your motivation a little bit more.
One, this is a piece that I go back and forth on. Is I think it's valuable to have, in the words of Jim Collins, big, hairy, audacious goals.
Sure.
Right? The things that are right on the edge of what you think could be possible, right? But it's something that's going that you really want to manifest in reality. And so I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with having big stretch goals. And for some people, right, this is stuff that everybody else tells them is impossible, that has never been done before. Mm-hmm. Felix Baumgartner, when he decided that he was going to jump out of space and skydive from not sky, right? He was going to space dive.
He space dived. Space dove?
Yes. Yeah. Space dove. Right. That's a big, hairy, audacious goal. Yeah. Right. But you got to believe he didn't lay in bed and go, man, that thing. Right. He broke it down. He figured out what the very next step was in order for him to then make progress towards it.
Yeah.
And then he poured his energy into that very next step. He didn't pour his energy into, man, one day I'm going to go space diving. And so I think that your point about breaking it down, and it's nice to have that off on the horizon. Mm-hmm. But if I'm pouring more energy into paying attention to the horizon than to what's right in front of me, then I'm going to end up off track.
Yeah.
And that's going to, as you pointed out, especially when I'm very rigid about that's the thing and it has to be the thing and it's going to happen and it's going to happen on this timeline, that it's going to cause a lot of anxiety. I'm going to worry about, am I on the right track? Am I making enough progress? Am I going to get into that school? Am I going to make that team? Am I?
And you're very likely to become risk averse, calculated risk averse with that. Outcome-based goals are not a bad thing. It's our relationship with them that we have to be able to be aware of and manage, because I would dare say it is a human psychological need to have meaningful outcomes and to pursue them. I would say it's also really helpful for us to be able to actually detach from them if we're going to make progress toward them. Because otherwise we're not present enough with the thing that we're doing. And if we're not present enough with the thing we're doing, we're not actually moving toward them. And then at the same time, what we're actually doing, like, it is about the journey and the destination. We need meaningful destinations to pursue. But you have to be able to get into the journey. It is about both. They're both important. Like, there's no client that I work with where the outcomes in their lives, future or current, are not important to them and don't have impact over their lives. They very rarely have more impact over their direct experience than their direct experience, which is happening right now.
And so if we wrap it all up, expectations are unavoidable and we can learn to let go of them so that they're not dragging us around when it's time to perform.
If need be.
And goals and intentions are valuable, and they're only, I guess, the litmus test for their value is how capable are they of allowing you to be free and present when it's time to be connected to your direct experience?
Yeah, really.
How on time can you be?
A really valuable thing to ask ourselves about anything that we are attached to is, like, what am I actually getting from them? Like, a basic psychological question for us, like, even the most basic of counseling techniques or psychological evaluation and intervention, just ask, like, what are the natural consequences of the things that I have coupled myself to? And sometimes there are points of diminishing returns. Having a big, hairy stretch goal can be really valuable. The point of diminishing return is if it starts disrupting your ability to be where you are and get the most out of the thing that you're actually doing, including executing your skills effectively. Because if we get super attached to it, what it does is start to disrupt our ability to be present, which, again, if we're really talking, like, what is the footprint we're looking for? It's your actual actions, decisions, and how well you actually execute your skills. If your goals are drawing you out of that, then it's probably time to reel back and think about how to perhaps reconstruct them or learn to be able to detach from them a little bit.
Beautiful.
It was a lot today.
Yeah. We have a couple of closing questions.
Okay.
And so I love asking this question kind of across the board. And so it's, you can apply it to the work that you're doing with performers, or you could apply it to yourself as a performer.
Okay.
Dealer's choice. But describe to me your beautiful moment.
I would say professionally, there's a type of beautiful moment that I try to make sure that I tune into whenever it happens. And it happens for almost everyone. It's just a matter of when. If we as practitioners are doing good work and they are willing to do the work, what happens is there's going to be this moment. It seems like it's a kicking point, but it's actually not. What's happening is behind the scenes, as they're doing the inner work, the stuff that we're talking about, is they're getting closer and getting closer and getting closer and getting closer. They're chipping away. And eventually there's this tipping point where something, their direct experience with something, changes. And it seems like things happen all at once, even though it's been building in the background for a while. But that moment for them is, it's very gratifying as a professional to see people get to that, especially when they have put in the work to be able to earn that moment, in a kind of a subjective way to describe that. And very rarely is that moment, Raymond, I won. It's, Raymond, I did it how I wanted to do it. And then oftentimes that is paired with a result that they're really looking for. But when somebody knows how to align themselves, when it is immensely difficult to do so because of your surroundings or perhaps what your past has been and what your reflexes have developed, and you do something different when you could have done something destructive for your performance. I mean, we're talking dopamine rich experience for them, but also you, that is what builds self-efficacy, where you go, oh, I just did a hard thing and I know how to do it again. That's a sustainable change. That's a beautiful moment to witness for other people. I know I've had a couple of those in my life, but when you see it in somebody else who has been working for that and the light goes off of like, oh, it's a beautiful thing.
Really cool. No, really cool.
Yeah.
Two more questions.
Fire away.
For those keeping track at home. How much of performance is mental and how much of it is physical?
I don't know. I don't know that anyone really knows. I think it might depend on the task. But what I would say is whether it is 99% mental and 1% physical, or 1% physical and 99%, whatever the ratio might be, even if our psychology is only that 1%, the other 99% is revolving around it. So it doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter what the percent is. It's the primary cog that all the other gears are turning around. And so I don't know what percent it is, but it's the most important percent.
That's a bold statement. That is a bold statement. And okay, so last question. You've been working on a new book.
I got a book.
Well, that wasn't a question. It was a statement.
That is a statement.
And so my question is, what would you like to share with us about your book?
Yeah, I've been operating in the golf world for a while now. And I felt you had the podcast that we're on right now is a pandemic baby for you. My pandemic baby was I finally sat down and read enough and wrote the book that I've been hoping to provide for golfers. That is a sphere that I am particularly fond of. It has been my professional opinion that the psychology available to golfers has been of low quality and pretty surface level. What I tried to do was really dive into the research and write a book that is not just some pithy catchphrases and kind of surface level, well, if you're not feeling confident, then be confident. Or if you're not present, just be present, and really tangibly teach people how, not just what, and also give them the information behind it so they can actually understand their brain and their mind and like what thoughts look like that create anxiety, what thoughts look like that create stable confidence, how you would actually train mindfulness, how to address your behaviors that are reflexive and turn them and perhaps change them if you would like to. So that's coming out in May, which I am excited to be. I'm excited that that's coming out. And that has been a long process, but it's coming out pretty quick. So it is the science-based version of golf psychology that I really think is going to challenge the status quo of psychology in that realm.
Very exciting. And I know,
thanks.
Having watched and, been around you as you've been going through the process, that it's been long and you've put a ton of effort into it.
It's no small task to write a book this way.
And, I imagine that there were also moments of, on-timeness while you were going through the experience, or else you wouldn't have found yourself at the end of the big, hairy, audacious goal, which writing a book inevitably is.
There were times where I would be writing and I would 100% be in flow state. Not all of the book was like that, but there were definitely some portions. It was also a really good opportunity for me to really go back and get really crisp and clear on some different areas of the research and really be more knowledgeable about that and just do better work for my clients as a result too. So it's been a good thing. I'm excited for it to come out. I'm also a little pretty excited to not be writing it anymore, to be honest.
All right. I lied. This is the last question.
Okay.
If people wanted to find you, where would they find you? Not physically. I'm talking about internet-wise.
Sure. On the interweb. You can find me on my website, which is btsmindset.com. BTS stands for Beneath the Surface, which is kind of my brand, I suppose. btsmindset.com. You can catch me on Twitter at BTS_mindset. And by catch me on Twitter, I mean my account, but I don't really revolve in the social media circles. So you could also just email me at rpryor@rfpsport.com if you need to.
And we'll have all of those linked in the show notes and the whole standard podcast rigmarole.
Yeah, for sure.
Ramon, this has been a long time coming, and glad to, if I was going to have a first in person, I'm glad that it was you. So thank you for the time and for sharing so much with me.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming by. It's been a long time coming. I'm glad we got to get it done. Maybe we'll do it again sometime.
Yeah, I mean, if you got another 2 or 8 hours on your hands, we'll just hit record and let it roll.
That sounds good. Thanks for having me, Pete.
Yeah, thank you. All right, that's it for today. If you liked this episode, make sure you subscribe to the show and don't forget to rate and leave a review. If you want to dive deeper into the concepts and concrete practices from today, I'm talking access to show notes and the transcript for the episode and a whole bunch of other mental training goodies, head over to mtl.academy. That's mtl.academy. Each week after the episode goes live, I'll also be sharing a worksheet that's going to help you level up your mindset and mental skills. And the only way to get access is through our weekly newsletter. So when you hit the bottom of the webpage, don't forget to sign up for that too. Until next time, be well.